Welcome to Symphony Week. It's a great legacy from the Spokane Symphony and something that the Spokane Symphony has initiated a long time ago. And very early on, when the idea of a symphony getting together with its public radio station, spending a week of really getting in deep with it, was pretty exciting for the world of orchestras, and it caused Spokane Symphony to earn a few awards and kudos for that, and allowed me to go to one of the Symphony League conventions and talk about this idea. So, yes, you and Spokane are part of a pioneer tradition that continues. Didn't happen last year, but here we are this year. So in just a moment, we bring in the executive director and the conductor of the Spokane Symphony, and then a little bit later, the concertmaster, Mateusz Wolski, who has his violin available, and so we will get in deep to that. But anyway, let's begin. First, I want to bring in Jeff Umsall, the executive director of the Spokane Symphony. Good morning, Jeff.
Good morning, Vern. It's so good to hear your voice.
And you are the person who has been here through the whole time making impossible decisions, right? Was your character and nature and training suited for impossible decisions?
Oh, boy. That's a tough one to answer. I mean, I will say, I think like many of us, we have so many combinations of feelings and hopes and aspirations right now. Some tempering going on, obviously. We're not quite out of the woods. I will say that we have gotten better at adaptation. Boy, we're adapting every 10 minutes these days. And I mean, the big message is just, this is our ultimate recapitulation. This is the return of the theme here. And we just can't wait to get on the stage with an audience. It's been way too long. So we are excited.
And then also certainly James Lowe, who's been back in town for a couple of weeks. Welcome back, James.
Thank you, Ben.
And even as we have both you and Jeff here, I don't want to spend a long time looking back, and I don't want to look back too much to the problems that you've had to overcome, but I do want to look back for just a couple of minutes to the series that was put together for last spring, that wonderful five-concert series that you were able to put together. So let's have a recapitulation of that, first as idea and then as execution, between you and Jeff to talk about that.
Well, thanks, Ben. I mean, it's some of the work I'm most proud of, I have to say. It was a difficult thing to put together. I mean, there's a lot of digital content out there and available, a lot of it for free, so we wanted to do something different. We wanted to do something that reflected Spokane and the community we have. So each episode has a theme, and the theme is explored through both music and chats with our musicians and some incredible people that we have hanging around here and in the Northwest. So it was a really great project. We did it together at Hamilton Studio, who are an amazing partner. I think, it looks wonderful. It sounds fantastic. It's still available online if anybody wishes to go and check it out. And I'm really proud that we managed to pull it together in probably the most difficult circumstances I've ever experienced in my career. I'm pretty sure that's the same for everyone.
And talk a little bit about the actual emotions of doing it.
Well, it was, Jeff just mentioned adaptation. It was adaptation writ large. We hadn't done something like this before. We had to figure out a way of making it work. It was a huge amount of work for all concerned, but to have music again sounding on the Fox stage, it was incredible, and after such a long time of uncertainty and silence, to be able to put out a product like that, I won't say it was a huge relief. It was more than that. It was a really emotional thing. I remember the very first thing we did was this beautiful Vaughan Williams variance on Dives and Lazarus, which starts very beautifully. And, the first chords, it was quite I think I wasn't alone in welling up a little bit on stage, I have to say.
And so that allowed that sequence to happen. And then kind of going back to Jeff here for a moment, talk about, just briefly, about the mechanism of getting it out to people and getting people involved and able to hear it on over their Zoom means and such.
Right. And this, of course, is where there is a departure from, you know, the way that we take in a concert or an experience at the Fox with its majesty and the consistency with which we can deploy these events. You know, this is a challenge that we all face in the orchestra world, in that one's home setup may vary from one to another. So somebody may have a wonderful hi-fi system and someone else may have a less wonderful hi-fi system. But what we did is that we used Vimeo, which is a well-known program, and they have, you know, versions that are sort of called over the top, like a more like a Netflix situation. We opted for one that was a slightly simpler interface. And so, you know, we gave access to our patrons, our season ticket holders, through our website. And then they could look at the concerts, you know, sort of as close to in real time as we could. We had a regular debut date for each of the five episodes that we put out. And then they remain in the present tense. They remain available for people to watch and to enjoy together now. And so, you know, that like James said, boy, that was a challenge. It was a reimagination. I think we all got a few extra MacGyver stripes on our shirt this last year of having to sort of figure things out in real time. You know, ultimately it was an industry-wide awakening and a question. You know, everybody in the industry is always looking for that next thing, and perhaps a panacea, if you will. Right? We often when we're here together, we're talking about, you know, what's changing, what's coming down the pipeline, what are the new ways that we're supporting what we do, the great work that we do. Will this force an evolution or sort of a revolution in the way that people consume concerts? And I think the answer is it's a mixed message. It's a little bit complicated. Yes, in some ways, you know, I can now tune in to see whether it's the Berlin Philharmonic or the Albany New York Symphony. I have access to all sorts of amazing content. I think what it also has taught us and demonstrated is that being a part of a symphony is a bunch of things. It is, yes, it is hearing music, but it is also seeing those people up on the stage that you know and you might see in the grocery store getting a gallon of milk, that you see teaching your kids or in the schools, and that it reconfirms and cements this notion that we ultimately, we're a community organization, and we are tightly wound to our community. So I will say this, I think it was amazing that we could do the work we did. We wouldn't have had the success we had last year with remaining close to our patrons and our supporters had we not done it. But boy, oh boy, I am looking forward to Saturday night and going out on that stage and saying hello to, you know, our audience and applauding for the orchestra that's there. That will be a groundswell of energy that I think is well-deserved and is just incomparable. It's really hard to duplicate that in any other form.
Jeff Umsall, the executive director of the symphony. Let's keep you for one more moment here on this conversation, Jeff. Before we now look forward and think of all the wonderful things to come, go ahead and repeat what I want us to say many times in the course of this week. What are the exact entrance requirements for getting into the Fox on this weekend?
Thank you. Thank you for saying that. And I just want to start by saying that, you know, this is an ongoing conversation. We're very fortunate to have a really committed board and staff and musician group. We have a health and safety committee that meets every week. In fact, I'm going to go into that meeting very, very shortly. So here are the bullet points. So as for any indoor location now, you need to have a mask on, and we really do need to have people wear them the whole time, except while actively drinking. So yes, if you get that little glass of wine you can take in, sure, have a quick sip, but then we're gonna hope that people do put that mask back down. And then in terms of vaccination requirement, so yes, there is a vaccination requirement. So either bring your card or bring proof of, right, a little photograph of your vaccine card works. If you do not have that vaccine card, you can get a test, and within 48 hours of the concert time, if you have that test done, you can bring that verification piece of paper with you. And so what will happen is we will have sort of two waves of of entry. First, the health check. People sort of walk by, show their card, or show their show the negative test. People will have folks, security and our ushers will check that, and then you'll go in, and then you'll, as normal, ushers will greet you and scan your ticket, and you'll walk in and have a really good time.
Okay, that's Jeff Vamsal, of the executive director of the symphony. Now we're going to move forward and talk in large terms of creating a season. So fascinating to me, in many aspects of our civilization, the ways we've changed, the things that have gone on in our world, in every direction. And I see that represented in the totality of the season you created. So I want you each, and we'll have to, I guess, decide who talks first, but talk about the overview of your season, because it doesn't look like a season you would have created 3 years ago. For one thing, I see a really strong aspect of Black composers on the season. I see the sense of Spokane. I see the sense of legacy, and many kind of ways in which we are different represented in the way I see that you planned this season. So I don't know, one of you has to decide who to speak first on the philosophy which guided you in who we are now, and therefore what kind of orchestral season do we need. Do we start with James for that?
I'd certainly happily kick off. I mean, I think, you know, an orchestra is a mirror to society. You know, all art that is being produced right now is a mirror to society. So, of course, our programming is going to always reflect that. And I think 3 years ago, it was reflecting in the same way. These, actually, amazingly, are my first program Masterworks concerts that have been put before the public in Spokane. So I'm kind of nervous because the year that I programmed previously was the COVID year that got cancelled. So these are the first times, I guess, people can come and see what I do. I mean, for me, I think, generally speaking, I think what a symphony should have a range of works that appeal to a broad range of people. So people who are like me, absolute classical music nerds, there's lots of really cool stuff to dig into. There's some rarities, there's some well-known pieces, and there's some surprises and some thought going in there that I think is really fun. And then if you're you know, more of a general listener, we've got all kinds of things, you know, like Star Wars movies, pop series. So there's really kind of something for everyone. That's the broad thing. And then I would say, for me, I love putting together programs. It's one of the most enjoyable parts of my job, although probably one of the hardest. And every program for me should be some kind of journey, either around an idea. So if you look forward to the Beethoven concert, the idea is exploring Beethoven's kind of inner life, you know, his soul, how he suffered, but also how he triumphed against all the things that were really impacting him. Obviously, everybody knows about him going deaf, but it wasn't just that. He was, you know, he could be quite a lonely guy, and yet his music has this incredible sense of hope always. So I think that's the kind of message of that concert. The first Masterworks is actually just more of an emotional journey. I figured we needed to go through some kind of healing and processing of the year we've had. So we start with this Hailstalk Fanfare on Amazing Grace, which, you know, is a tune that I think represents the, whatever your beliefs, the grace that has brought us all through this point to being back on stage here. And then Sibelius Violin Concerto is obviously a bit more dark and melancholy. And then we end with this Brahms symphony that ends in real kind of, I would say, comforting music and joyful music. So it's a kind of an emotional journey through the first program. So like I say, you know, they're just two examples. But for me, I think making a program, it's like a game of 3D chess. You're looking at the overall offering and also kind of drilling down deeply into the individual concerts to make sure that they make sense.
That was James Lowe. And then as we go to Jeff Vamsal, you're the person who has been here in this community for the last 18, 19 months and in touch with the community. So kind of your take on the same subject of, especially as later on you have the concert, the genesis of the Spokane Symphony, and you, and by Eckhart returning, and many things like that. What do you see kind of as the things the symphony is trying to really engage with the community about?
You know, I think to me, the term that comes up is linkage. I think it is about our linkage to our heritage, to our past, to the most recent form of ourselves that we were in, you know, pre-pandemic. Boy, this organization was cooking with lots of concerts, and the Fox was busy. Boy, it feels like, you know, every day of the week. It wasn't quite that much, but it was really going. But I think it's also a bit of an internal linkage, a linkage to ourselves, and to, as James said, to this really unique opportunity to heal, to be reflective. There's something that's always so ironic and sort of paradoxical about being in the Fox amongst, you know, 1,000 other patrons, and getting into that flow state, you know, staring up at that sunburst that we all know so well. And by the second movement and the second half of the concert, being fully transported somewhere that you would not have gotten otherwise, and letting yourself sort of be immersed and the waves of the music sort of lapping over you. I'm looking forward to that. I mean, boys, even I'm thinking about it, I haven't had that in a while. I think none of us have. So, you know, creating a place in our world where we can have that, where, yes, it is special, but it's also something that we look forward to. And it is a little bit expected. The symphony is a consistent part of many of our lives here. The goal in our season is to restore that sense of belonging for our patrons to us and us to them, and that we have this beautiful sort of interdependent relationship with our community that, again, I've said this before on the show, is quite unique in this country. I have seen other orchestras and other communities, and they all have some wonderful things about them. This love affair that the community has with us is something to behold and to not take for granted. And we need to do our absolute best to give people that special feeling that they come for.
James Bumsalda, Executive Director of the Spokane Symphony, which is returning to this stage, as we've been discussing, this Saturday night and Sunday afternoon with the first of the Classical Masters concerts. Later on in the week, we will discuss some of the other aspects of the symphony, certainly the chorale and the education programs, and the many other things, as Jeff, you said, before the pandemic, when the symphony was just, it had so many directions going. And while we'll leave most of that discussion to the people that'll be talking at the time, talk about the symphony behind the scenes for a moment, the symphony that the Saturday night concert goer doesn't encounter, and some of the hopes and ways to try to get the orchestra back involved that way.
Sure. So, I mean, you know, it is always interesting to see sort of how does the sausage get made? It is complicated. And at the end of the day, we are a people organization. You know, we exist to serve people, and we're made up of people. As we all know, we had to go down on our staffing quite substantially during these last few months, and we're working our way back up. And it is great to have the faces back, you know, behind the stage and working on things, staff meetings, and all sorts of different things happening. We are again working with Don Hamilton Studio, to present, you know, video versions post concert of our performances, and so that's another interesting layer to kind of think through of how to interpolate and add that to the overall experience. And boy, you know, I've been spending tons of time on getting our committee list back together of the, you know, the 80 different committee meetings that happened during the year, and back to biweekly event meetings, because we've got weddings and we've got other events. We had an event on Saturday night. That was the first sort of big, large scale concert we had had in the Fox in, again, the sort of year and a half that we're all talking about. So, It's a beehive of activity. It's great for me. I love it. I love to immerse myself in this world. And you know, the whole point is that it is for a purpose. It is for this great these great moments of joy that we sort of climb these mountains, and then we can look out over the valley of the work that we've done and celebrate together. So, yes, it is a cumulative effort.
Jeff Umsall, and earlier we were speaking with James Lowe, both of whom will be back with us in the course of this week of Symphony Week. Tomorrow we'll spend time with Eckhart Proy and also time with two of the veteran members of the symphony, because we do have performances as part of these Symphony Week programs. So for the moment, thank you, Jeff, and thank you. And thank you, James, for your time this morning.
Thank you, Ver. Thank you.
And what we'll do, because the concert does open with this composer, Adolphus Hale Storck, whom we're actually hearing in many different places over the next few days. We'll hear more of his music on the program played live in our studio later this week. And it's even one of his pieces is being played by the Eroica Trio tonight or tomorrow night. So we're going to hear a 5-minute piece by Adolphus Hale Storck, the Black composer, and this is his Adagio for strings, his version.
Thank you.
Adagio for Strings is a title that we know well, and and that we know it certainly from Samuel Barber, but that's the Adagio for Strings, which was created by Adolphus Hailstork, whose composition opens the symphony's program on Saturday night and Sunday afternoon. And it is a piece, as he does with many pieces, based on something else. He calls it Fanfare on Amazing Grace. Okay, now we get to have a musician, and that's what we're doing every day in Symphony Week here. And Mateusz Wolski is certainly a good friend of the station, comes in many times with whatever's going on in your interesting life. Welcome back, Mateusz.
Good morning, Vern. And I just have to take did you intend to have a little dig at calling me a musician, but our conductor and not?
Well, see, it's because you and I are both married to singers.
Yes.
And we know that sensitivity of hearing about singers and musicians.
Yes, too, yeah, no, that's an inside joke. Sorry, no, I just had to take a dig at this because that's a really funny, the whole relationship of us. Having, you know, somebody telling us what to do. So therefore, you have the musicians and then you have the leaders, right? No, but we love each other.
You do, certainly. And a good sneak preview to tomorrow when we'll be talking with a recording I made with Eckhart Proy. And he says some really interesting things about the world of conductors. So we'll get there. Anyway, I just ran into you in the grocery store right now. You're buying your gallon of milk. And I say, Mateusz, what have you done for a year and a half? Which I know a lot of people have done that. I've gotten to follow a lot of it on Facebook. But both the musical and the non-musical. First of two or three quick things in the non-musical world.
Oh, in the non-musical world. Well, you know, some people that know me know that one of my passions outside of music playing is actually racing my little car. So as a matter of fact, I just raced this weekend. It's a nice outdoor activity that is sort of COVID-proof. So part of the process is that I also kind of sort of build and wrench on my car. So in the off time, I had a time to rebuild my engine and put it back together. I didn't have any screws left over, so I assumed I did it correctly, and it proved to be correct. It's a very fast car, and I've had a great success racing it, and putting some good fights against my typical competition that I have not seen for a couple of years. So that's kind of my off the beaten path activity. But as far as the musical stuff is concerned, you know, there's been a lot of happening because, like, just like any artist that is sort of used to a certain pace of your life, which means, hey, every weekend I get to go and perform something. When sort of COVID took it away from all of us, after 3 weekends of not having performed, you start to feel grumpy and out of place, and you realize that you just need that dopamine, that adrenaline hit when you're gearing up for a performance and you're trying to deliver something under pressure. You know, that's what makes you feel really alive. You take that away and you have like a drug addict. You're completely in this withdrawal. So you have all those withdrawal symptoms. So then you start to look, what can I do since I cannot really go in front of the audience? And, you know, back early in the pandemic, there's so much, so many unknowns. And how long is this going to last? What are we going to look like in a year or two? What's the end? So, of course, you start to turn into online activities. So, you know, as we mentioned earlier on the program, you know, James put this absolutely amazing project with the orchestra and us recording it virtually without the audience on the stage, distanced, masked, you know, which essentially triples the difficulty of already a hard job, because, you know, it's hard to, you know, when you have a mask on your face and you try to perform, you start to realize that you rely on a lot of information from other people's faces. You know, that's the joy of making music. You look, you smile to another person when you trade phrases and you pass the music along. And also it's the same thing, you know, when the things are going well and conductor occasionally smiles at you, like, "Ooh, we're doing really good." Now, the James, the only thing he can do is wink at us when the things are going well, which is, you know, we learn how to wink those cues, and the, you know, when he winks at you, you know, like, we're doing well. So, which is very, very fun. So you know, so that, and then on top of everything else, you know, when you perform live, it's sort of like what happens at the Fox stays at the Fox, right? Which means that you're much more likely to take chances. So for the maybe non-player listeners, is, you know, there are several ways of playing your instrument. Some that are safe and typically, you know, kind of they feel a little bit boring, and then there are some that are definitely dangerous. That's, you know, what the virtuosity is about, you know, is doing something that is usually very dangerous and completely unnecessary, but we do that because we love to challenge ourselves. When you do it in front of the live audience, you have that energy and this kind of you know, environment that you take chances. Now, when you put a microphone and a camera right next to you, all of a sudden it's, you know, it's like, okay, if I do that and it doesn't work out, it's just going to stay there forever. You know, it's just like stupid post on the Facebook or something that you have never put out there. So you know, so there's this, so then all of a sudden you have this whole mental game. Should I play it safe? Or should just go for it? And you know, and then in order to go for it, you have to find a way how to essentially become not, you know, how should I say it? You just try to become not aware about the surroundings. You're trying to lose yourself in the music. And that is very difficult to do in the recording session when you just have to flip a switch and just go for it. So that's been a really, really big challenge, but I think we actually all together managed it, and again with the great leadership, and you know, a few laughs here and there, and you know, we pulled it off. So, but there's nothing quite like what we are trying to do this weekend, which is being back on stage and playing together. So yeah,
and so that certainly will be coming along, and we're going to talk in a bit about a couple of your real focal points. But in a way, everything is a focal point, because in Great Britain they call the concertmaster the leader, and I think that's an appropriate thing, because you do have certain obligations, don't you, beyond playing your instrument well, like everybody else in the orchestra does? What are some of your obligations toward, uniquely from your position?
You know, I think that's you know, as we started this whole conversation about us joking that there is typically the relationship between the orchestra and the conductor is one of a more of a conflict, because especially in today's society, you don't like somebody to tell you what to do, right? So, but realistically speaking, you know, it's synergy, but there is an element that, you know, of attention that can produce the results. So you have the orchestra versus conductor, and the concertmaster is like the person that is stuck between the rock and the hard place, which means you have to be the glue, and you have to find a ways how to communicate in a verbal and nonverbal way, and advocate for both sides. So I mean, that's how I see my role quite a bit. Also, you know, because I'm I'm visible because I walk on the stage and tune the orchestra. There's a lot of people that do recognize me when I go and try to get the gallon of milk in the store. People look up to you, and they want to know, how is the symphony doing? How you know, when are you guys going to play again? What's going on? So in a way, you feel a little bit like a spokesman for the musicians as well, you know. And you try to stay connected and keep tabs on all your friends, see how they're doing. You know, are you ready to get back on the stage, perform? Are we comfortable? You know, because the big part of, I think, especially of our orchestra, there's a lot of families. You know, we have number of married couples in the orchestra. So, I mean, it's really a family affair. And I think that the reason why we play as well as we do is because we do stay connected. We communicate with each other and try to support each other, especially in the tough times. So, you know, so I see my role as a glue, mostly. as well as the spokesman occasionally, even though I have a funny accent, but that's a whole other story.
We're used to that. Mateusz Wolski, the man with the funny accent. Let's talk about the two focal points that you have as a soloist this year. And you might just need to grit your violin right now.
I brought it in here. Look, magic, right?
Yeah, you just happen to have it. And I'm going to change my mind from what we were previously thinking, because you've already in the outdoor concert a week ago done a little bit of this. But is the wonderful way that the violinist is the storyteller in Scheherazade in so many ways. It's so talk about kind of your lifetime of awareness of Scheherazade. I assume as a young violinist you saw, wow, that's one of the great tunes I'm going to get to play sometime. And then talk about a current relationship you would have with that piece.
You know, it's the Rimsky-Korsakov's Scheherazade is just one of those absolutely amazing pieces of music that has a backstory as a concept, but I don't think it's like super literal, at least not to me. So the beauty of playing music is that whenever you try to shape a musical phrase, some people like to create images in their mind and kind of sort of play the notes with the image behind it. Some people love to tell stories. I think mostly about the emotions, which means, you have the Scheherazade, you have this, theme that some people might have heard before. And each time you play it, it keeps coming back in the piece. I tend to think it's like, what kind of mood is she in? Is she trying to be very, very, sweet and delicate? Sort of like the way the first time I played it is. Or is she all of a sudden more capricious, feeling the. You can create so much character with that tune, and it appears not very difficult, but actually it's the way he wrote it, it's absolutely atrocious for a violinist, because you have a lot of pitches that are repeated over and over and over again, and if you, God forbid, one of your fingers just doesn't quite make it, anybody can hear it, a non-musician can hear it, it's like, oh, that one sounded off, can we get a new concert master? That's, I think, for me personally, what makes the piece is, number one, that I'm a man trying to play a sort of a female role, which usually in the world of the opera is the other way around. It's when you have the females trying to play the pants roles. But so that's the first island. But then the second, you're sort of trying to put yourself into this understanding, what mood is she in? What kind of story is she trying to tell? And obviously she's trying in the story of 1001 Nights, which Scheherazade is based on, she's trying to survive yet another night and not be beheaded by her sultan husband. So she kind of leads him on with these stories and doesn't finish them till the next night. So that's how she stays alive. So it's kind of in the back of your mind as you play that piece. It's, you have to use your imagination and always create something new and interesting. So the audience wants to hear you playing the same tune again, but slightly different, so they're not bored.
And you already did a good, great job of showing kind of the different character of the basic tune. Then what about when Rimsky-Korsakov extends it beyond those, pitches that you just played for us? Do you have an example of a way that he stretches it and goes in some different direction your solo?
Oh, in his solos. I mean, he does the, I've been racing all weekend, and you're putting me on the spot here, making me play difficult stuff. Yeah, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
So what he does is this very funky bowing techniques. For example, there's a one cadenza that goes like this. That kind of stuff is really quite tricky to control, especially under pressure, because you have to throw the bow and then let it bounce sort of by itself. So you have to trust your bow, you have to trust your violin, and conditions always change. Even the smallest variation in humidity will affect the bow hair that is made out of the horse hair. And if you ever look at the like old hygrometer that tells you what's the air humidity, there's a horse hair inside that stretches and absorbs the moisture or expels it. And that essentially, that tension moves the needle, if anybody would care to know. You know, I'm full of irrelevant facts. No,
that's a fabulous, connection you just made.
But that essentially will affect the bow tension. And you know, like smallest changes in the humidity or temperature will affect how your bow behaves. So you know, as early in the conversation, Jeff said, you know, musicians have to adapt to a lot of things. Mm-hmm. On one hand, COVID, on the micro scale, you know, we constantly have to adapt to sort of the conditions, and that actually affects our instruments, which are made out of natural materials. Mm-hmm. You know, don't get me started on the woodwind players with the reeds right. and stuff. You know, they constantly fiddle around with that. Anyway,
but I was going to say we'll maybe take the recording of what you just said, and you could replace violin playing with car racing and about the same things, that the conditions change and you have to adapt to it, and so it's a real commonality between two tricky things to do, right?
Well, why do you think I love it so much? It's because it's so different, but yet it's so the same. You know, in a performance, you have just this one shot and at trying to play beautiful music, but it's like walking a tightrope that somebody is trying to shake underneath you all the time and see if you can stay on it. Depending on the composer, you know, they can make it harder or easier. And in the car racing, it's the same thing. You have the pressure, you have to perform best you can, then you have your competition that comes in, and you know, when you have the banter, it's like, oh, that was pretty fast, but you know, yeah, I think this is only as fast as you can ever go. I was like, oh, he's beating you. Did you see? Yeah. He's like, he's 200ths of a second faster. Are you going to catch him? You know, you have that kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. On the stage, it's more of like your inner dialogue. Mm-hmm. It's like, oh, there's this big, very challenging solo coming. Okay, here we go. You know, I got this. I was like, ooh, that. Kind of, I'm feeling weak in the knees. Is today the day that things are not going to work out? I mean, there's a lot of stuff that could be going through your head, but then if you try to just be the music, and you try to be the character, you try to be the emotion, then usually that, at least for me, takes care of it, and I just try to be.
Yeah. So we'll park the car, we'll send Scheherazade back to bed, and we'll talk about the Tchaikovsky Concerto, which you're doing in February. Pretty interestingly, Oz, the big solo European piece on a concert that otherwise has an interesting Black History Month aspect to it, with two Black composers on it. But so the Tchaikovsky Concerto, speaking of chestnuts of things that you've known all your life and played all your life. What happens when you get ready to start thinking about playing the Tchaikovsky Concerto again?
So, you know, so I have a backstory to the whole Tchaikovsky Concerto, because that's one of the big ones on my bucket list. So if some of the audience knows that, you know, every year I play a major concerto with the orchestra, and, you know, I've been slowly chipping at the favorites, you know, the Sibelius, the Brahms, the Scottish Fantasy, you know, all the kind of the greatest hits that you always wanted to play. And Tchaikovsky is one of those pieces that it was actually the very first concerto that I've heard on the recording. My aunt had this LP that I listened to, and it was Tchaikovsky, and I remember just when I started to learn how to play the violin, that just by listening, I started to learn the piece just by ear. And the funny thing is, I didn't even realize it was a solo violin concerto. I just really liked the music, so I played the orchestra part, the solo violin parts, you know, kind of intermingled with each other. Didn't understand the whole concept of what the concerto is, and that was actually like a first violin concerto that I fell in love with. Now, the problem is also that that's one of the tricky ones. So you have to spend quite a bit of time to learn your craft to finally feel like you're capable of delivering and giving piece of justice. So at this point, I, I mean, I'm quite confident I can. So that's why we programmed it. But you know, it's a journey, because I think the way Tchaikovsky wrote that piece is just incredibly brilliant in terms of tunes. They're, you know, all of the tunes are singable. You know. You know, you hear that, and then you can repeat it, right? For example, and then there's dance, just like, you know, there's bits like when we play Nutcracker. I mean, you play the Tchaikovsky violin, you know, there's just so much dance, there is so much singing, and there's a virtuosity with just super, that, you know, there's lots of flashy, very virtuosic stuff in a concerto, which makes it, I think, one of the favorite pieces that every violinist just dies to have an opportunity to play it with the orchestra. So I'm one of those very few and fortunate violinists that will get that chance, hopefully. I mean, fingers crossed. You know, and that's it's just definitely a highlight of my musical career, to be able to feel that I'm ready to tackle a piece like that. And, you know, and that journey took me, you know, only almost 40 years.
Mm. So, it's interesting, because as much as we think, oh, the Tchaikovsky, it's been a while since I've heard anybody play it. What does it do about cadenzas? Are there specific cadenzas that Tchaikovsky wrote, or is there any room for other possibilities?
So the Tchaikovsky comes with the pre-written cadenzas that, you know, occasionally there are some violinists that venture out in writing their own cadenzas for bits and pieces. But, you know, like, the way I feel about this, like with everything else, whether it's car racing or violin playing, in order to get good at something, you need to have enough practice. So, you know, I occasionally took a stab at writing a tiny little cadenza here and there for things, but I don't feel as confident in my abilities to, you know, write a tune as in my abilities to play a tune. So I leave the cadenzas on this one to Tchaikovsky, and I play what's written rather than try to, you know, contribute to a great work of art, and maybe, unfortunately, you know, spoil it just ever so slightly. So, you know, I sort of know where I am at this point with this kind of subject matter. I do admire other violinists that they take major violin concertos and they write their own cadenzas. But also they have a lot of opportunities to go and try it out in multiple venues, because if that's the only thing you do, you know, sometimes you actually get bored, so you want to do something else. Mm. You know, if you, you know, like, I remember, like, David Oistrakh, you know, I mean, how many times did he play his Tchaikovsky? 200, 300 times. You know, maybe first 100 times, it's a lot of fun, but then you're like, okay, should I try something new? I know. So you know, so that's the blessing and the curse also of the for example, the soloists that are concertizing and playing, you know, the same four or five pieces all the time, over and over and over again. They get great at playing them, but I also feel that there is a struggle of like, I have to do this tune again, occasionally. Mm-hmm. They never show it, but I know from the conversations that's definitely a burden that some of them carry.
Yeah. But you get to do it.
No, yeah, well, I get to do it. For me, it's like, hey, I mean, I don't get to do it this often, so it's as fresh and as vivid and as exciting as it possibly can get. So I think that brings a certain edge to a performer that maybe doesn't get... This is not something they don't get bored with it. So I'm sure that it's going to be very exciting. I'll be very excited. Hopefully the audience is going to be also very excited, and we're all going to have a great time.
That's in early February. I think if we do it right now, we would have just time to go back and hear you and Eckhart together playing the Liebeslied of Fritz Kreisler. Thank you. Leave aside that great Fritz Kreisler piece in a performance that was done in our studio by Mateusz Wolski and Eckhart Proy, and that's kind of a nice anticipation that tomorrow we'll be speaking with Eckhart Proy in his first appearance, about his first appearance back with the Spokane Symphony after retiring from that several years ago. And again, our thanks to Mateusz Wolski. And tomorrow we'll also hear from Leonard and Helen Byrne, who have some really fun stuff for us. They have a little Adolphus Hale stork, and also Mateusz was saying that the Spokane String Quartet, with which he's so closely involved, also has some Adolphus Hale stork on a program they're doing next February. So many, many things that, as happens often, are very congruent, including all the rest of the Symphony Week. So thanks to everyone involved.